Our next case for argument this morning is Horshaw v. Casper. Mr. Early.
May it please the court. Cormac Early on behalf of the plaintiff, Kirk Horshaw. A few days before my client was attacked and nearly killed by members of the prison gang, he warned both the guard and the warden that he had received a threat on his life from members of the gang. It's undisputed that neither one did anything to protect him. The only disputed issues in this case are, first of all, whether the warning my client provided to the guard was sufficiently specific, and second, whether the letter he sent to the warden ever actually reached the warden. And it's worth noting at the outset that the defendants are not arguing in this appeal that the warning contained in the letter to the warden was not sufficiently specific. They only argue that it didn't reach him. And that's important because the only distinction defendants have ever pointed to between the two warnings is that the letter to the warden mentioned a gang, and they now argue that the warning to the guard did not. There are two problems with that argument. First is that in their own statement of undisputed material facts, the defendants accept that my client stated that he had been threatened for disrespecting a gang member and would be eradicated. And that statement binds them on this appeal, even evidence in the record notwithstanding.
That was with respect to the warden or Casper or both?
That was Casper.
Okay.
So in the statement of undisputed material facts, it says that my client stated that he told Casper that he had been threatened for disrespecting a gang member. And accepting that is true, the warnings...
Where in the record will we find that he mentioned the involvement of a gang?
So that's in his deposition, and that's the second argument for why defendant's argument is not persuasive here. And it's simply that while we accept that my client did not specifically use the word gang when asked what he told the guard, Sergeant Casper, the best reading of the deposition as a whole is that he had explained at that point in the deposition three times already the full contents of the threat he had received. And he'd already said twice that he'd communicated that threat to Casper. And so, albeit somewhat inartfully, he incorporated the full contents of the threat in his response to that question. And that's at least as plausible a reading of the deposition and the surrounding context as defendant's contrary inference, which is that my client, who had received a note that he believed from a gang threatening his life, fearing for his life, immediately approached the first prison officer he saw and asked for protection. And that Sergeant Casper then discussed the threat with him, said he believed that it was credible and serious and would take it to the warden. And yet somehow my client never mentioned probably the most important detail, which is that the threat came from a prison gang. And when we're at the summary judgment stage, that inference is available and must be drawn in favor of my client. And if he did mention a gang, then it's clear from this court's precedence that that was a sufficiently specific threat to alert both the guard and the warden to the need to protect
himself. Counsel, I'm concerned about the claim against the warden. Why does sending a letter to a warden make the warden responsible for everything that happens? I mean, we've said in quite a few cases that wardens and attorneys general and secretaries of defense are entitled to rely on the division of labor, and they can't be made personally responsible for anything just by sending them letters.
Well, this court has also recognized that, well, there's certainly no respondeat superior doctrine for this kind of claim.
No, you're not thinking about this the way I'm trying to get you to think about it. We held in Vance against Rumsfeld, an en banc decision 6 years ago, that sending a letter to the Secretary of Defense saying your subordinates are misbehaving in the following ways did not make the Secretary personally responsible for that misbehavior. And that was on a principle of organization, that everybody, the head of every organization, can rely on the division of labor to do their job unless there is an objection to the policies established by the secretary. Now, if there's an objection to the policies established by the warden, about how these letters are to be dealt with, you know, how charges of gang violence are to be dealt with, one can imagine liability. But if it's just that the warden did not behave like an operational officer and behaved instead like a supervisor, that's problematic under Vance. That's the kind of question I'm asking.
Right. So specifically in the Farmer against Brennan line of cases involving prison officials, particularly as opposed to executive officials more generally, this court has recognized that notice to a warden, so another Vance case, Vance against Peters.
So do you think we have decisions contrary to an en banc decision? Which wins?
I don't think it's contrary, Your Honor. I think the prison context is in many respects...
You don't think it's contrary? You really know Vance? It didn't sound like you did.
Well, that's the other problem with that argument, Your Honor, which is that no one has briefed
Vance. How do you say it's
contrary?
The position is contrary to Vance if you haven't read it. You might say, I'm sorry, I don't know that case, I'm not in any position to discuss it. But saying, well, that position is contrary to Vance when you haven't read it, is not a way to proceed.
Certainly, Your Honor, and all of those answers apply, but I would say, based on your description of Vance, just in this argument, it does not sound like it's contrary, because that was a case involving an executive officer generally, and there are cases from this court clearly holding that wardens in the prison context specifically, when given personal knowledge, either in the form of a letter or in the form of being directly told of a warning, can be liable under the Farmer against Brennan line of cases. And defendants have never disputed that possibility of liability. And so to the extent there is an argument...
Well, that's a different point. They may have forfeited this line of argument.
Right. That argument has not been raised at all in this case. And that would be why I'm not familiar with Vance.
Counsel, I had understood our cases dealing with wardens to say not that a warden can't rely on subordinate staff to address such a matter, but that he would at least have to delegate if he gets a warning.
Well,
the warden doesn't have to go investigate himself or herself, but needs to make sure that somebody does.
Right, and the problem in this case is that the warden did nothing at all. And the only justification advanced for that lack of action is not that he relied on policies or that he relied on his subordinates, it's that he never received the letter at all. And the proof for that, they have two pieces of evidence for that. One is that he says in his deposition that he didn't remember it. Of course, that evidence is impeached because he said he didn't remember any letters from my client, and he clearly received at least one. That's undisputed. The other piece of evidence is the kite log, which was produced long after the close of discovery and long after counsel below had any opportunity to take discovery to impeach the declaration accompanying that kite log. And so the prejudice to my client from considering the kite log at summary judgment is obvious.
I thought your position was also, though, that even if the kite log is properly before the court, all it does is present a disputed issue of fact.
Right. So essentially, if the kite log is properly considered, which again we dispute, then a reasonable jury would have to either infer that something went wrong in the delivery system, in the prison mail system, or something went wrong in the recording system. Clearly, at least one of those flaws must have happened. And there's no sufficient evidence to break the tie between those inferences, and so it should go to a jury. But the case is a lot.
To guess? To guess which one is right?
Well, to determine the credibility, for example, of the warden's secretary who would testify, as against my client who would testify about the ordinary operation of prison mail and his understanding of placing the letter between the bars. But the kite log is not properly before the court on summary judgment, which makes this case a lot easier. And I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time, so if there are no further questions, mm-hmm. I'll sit down. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Ms. Bocianza.
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Linda Bocianza on behalf of defendants. This court has repeatedly noted that prisons are dangerous places, often full of people who have demonstrated aggression. As such, the Eighth Amendment is not violated every time an inmate gets attacked by another inmate. Instead, a prison official is only liable if she knows of and disregards an excessive risk to the inmate's safety.
How is a complaining inmate supposed to assess the probability of being attacked? There's a feeling in your brief and in the district court's opinion that because the letter didn't state the time, place, and manner of the attack, it could be ignored. But of course, potential murderers don't, except in an Agatha Christie story, a murder is announced. Murderers don't state the time, place, and manner of the crime. On your view, doesn't that make everything ignorable?
No, Your Honor, that's certainly not our view. Our view is not that he should have intuited who would attack him. Our view, and the case law supports, that he had to present the prison officials with enough objective information to enable them to do something about his complaint. So in this case,
I honestly don't know what more he could have done. You know, the warden seems to have testified that if he had received the letter that Horshaw says had sent, that the warden would have immediately placed him in protective custody. Why isn't that dispositive of the issue of whether the threat was specific enough to warrant a response? Or why is that not enough to, you know, at least put the issue to a jury?
Well, Your Honor, this, with respect to, so Casper is the official who Horshaw says he handed the note to. And he says that in the note he stated that I received a threatening note that I would be beaten and that I needed help. This court has cases that say that such notice is not enough to put the official on alert that there's an imminent risk to the inmate's safety. So in Grievason versus Anderson, the inmate told officers that he was afraid of other inmates and that he wanted to be moved. And this court ruled that such vague information did not put jail officers on notice right. to a specific...
Other inmates, right. How about a gang?
Your Honor, the record suggests that there are several gangs in Menard, and Horshaw didn't identify which gang to
Couldn't
narrow
they have
it down.
Asked him?
I'm sorry?
Couldn't they have asked him?
Well, Atchison never received his letter.
That's your theory. Okay. How about Casper?
Casper, he could have asked him, but Horshaw also could have offered that information, which would have, again, put Casper on notice of a more specific and more direct threat to his safety. There are, and the fact that there's a gang involved, I'm not sure how much that narrows it down, because the record suggests that there are several gangs at Menard, so... whether a gang in the abstract had threatened him doesn't necessarily put officers on notice of a specific threat to his safety. So this court has ruled that complaints that identify a specific, credible, and imminent risk of serious harm are enough to support...
Could you give me an example of something that does that but does not sound like a murder is announced?
Yes, Your Honor. So in the record shows that in this case, Horshaw was beaten because he insulted someone during a card game. So had he written a note saying something to the effect of, I got into an argument at a card game with these inmates and I would like help, that would have been more specific and that would have been more direct and the officers would have been able to...
Is our case law, where in our case law do we require that level of specificity?
Well, in Jeavis versus McLaughlin, this court said that a complaint that identifies specific, credible, and imminent risk of serious harm, and just saying in the abstract, I'm afraid that someone is going to beat me.
Well, I understand that. We're in between here.
Right.
So where do you get the requirement that it be more specific than this?
I think that Grievason versus Anderson involved a threat that was similarly vague in our view, and this court said that that was not enough to show that there was a serious risk to the inmate's harm. And again, the question is whether the prison officials were subjectively aware that there was an imminent risk to the inmate's safety. And in this case, simply stating, someone threatened me, I'm afraid, that's not enough to put the officers on notice of an imminent risk to his safety. So Horshaw's evidence with regard to Atchison is that he sent him one letter stating that a high-ranking gang member threatened to eradicate him. But Atchison...
Well, he both mentioned it and handed over a note.
To Casper.
I was taken with your argument that the log is conclusive evidence that the warden did not receive the letter, because it seems more like evidence that the letter wasn't recorded on the log, not that it wasn't received. Why isn't there a competing inference that the prison mail system works as it was supposed to work?
Well, Your Honor, Horshaw had counsel below, and he submitted his opposition to summary judgment in March of 2016. The district court issued its opinion in September, and in that time, Horshaw never sought to reopen discovery in order to ask the warden's assistant about her record keeping.
Didn't he object, though, to consideration of this late evidence?
He didn't file a formal objection. What he did was in his opposition, in a few lines on the first page of his opposition.
Most district courts prefer that to separate motions to strike, right?
Sure.
I understand Your Honor was a district court, so I will assume that that's correct.
It is. But given that objection, it's hard for me to see how, if a defendant moving party for summary judgment is relying on evidence that should properly be excluded under Rule 37, and you raise that proper objection, do you also have to say, and by the way, in the alternative, I'd like to do some more discovery?
I'm not sure that we need to set an ironclad rule that that's what should occur in all cases, but
why here?
I would submit that even in this case, even if the log was removed, which I don't think it should be, I think that it was within the district court.
What's the excuse under Rule 37 for failing to produce it?
I don't know.
Exclusion is mandatory unless you've got a good reason and the district judge decides to accept it. I haven't seen a reason here.
Fair enough. Well, even if you're...
What was the justification that was given?
As I understand it, Your Honor, the district court, the parties agreed to move back the deadline for filing dispositive motions. And as I read the record, I think that counsel didn't understand that that didn't affect the discovery deadline, and so the log that's being challenged was attached to his summary judgment motion, but hadn't been produced in advance of the discovery deadline.
This would seem to have been within the scope of even mandatory initial disclosures under Rule 26A1.
Okay, Your Honor, even if that's the case, and even if we remove the log from consideration, still, the letter that he sent to the warden was not specific enough to put the warden on notice.
The warden testified that if I had gotten this, I would have put him immediately in protective custody, as Judge Rovner pointed out.
Even if that is the case, Your Honor, we would submit that the defendants were still entitled to qualified immunity, because clearly established law doesn't dictate that a warden or a correctional officer having received one letter and not properly investigating a threat to an inmate, that they necessarily violate the Constitution. Unless this court has additional questions, we would ask that you...
Well, I do have a question whether you're relying on the theory of Part 4 of Vance against Rumsfeld.
Your Honor, I am not familiar with Vance.
Okay, well,
Rumsfeld.
Then you're obviously not relying on the theory of Part 4 of Vance against Rumsfeld.
I think that's
Thank
right,
you.
Ben. Thank you.
Mr. Early, anything further?
Yes, Your Honor, just briefly. This court and the Supreme Court have clearly established long before the time of this attack that knowledge of a particularly threatening class of inmates is sufficient, if a prison official has that knowledge, to put them on notice that they need to protect an inmate. So in Farmer against Brennan itself, where the threat was to a preoperative transgender female inmate in an all-male prison, the class of inmates was everyone, at least in 1994. In Brown against Buds, the class of inmates in that particular institution was African Americans, which, of course, African American inmates are not an inherently dangerous class of prisoners. Here, the threat was from prison gang members generally, which, of course, is an inherently threatening class of prisoners. Of course, it would have been more specific to say which particular gang, but on the strength of those precedents, it's absolutely clear, and certainly for qualified immunity purposes, that the class was specific enough to put everyone who received that warning on notice. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Early. We appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept our request in this case, and the assistance you've been to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.